Hi, folks. Steve Urban here, host of the Riderflex podcast and founder and CEO of our day job recruiting firm, Riderflex. We hope you enjoy this episode. And as a reminder, please subscribe to the podcast for updates and news. Finally, if you haven't already, check out the series of books we've published on hiring, interviewing, and overall career advice titled The Riderflex Guide, available on Amazon. And now, a quick word from our sponsor.
Most homeowners don't have the time or expertise to properly take care of their home, which causes costly issues to arise. That's where Kura Home Maintenance comes in. We're a full-service, routine maintenance company that was developed by a certified home inspector. Each quarter, we service our clients' homes following manufacturers' recommendations to properly maintain all the necessary appliances. We provide the materials and expertise to prolong the life of your property, creating a healthy and efficient environment for your family. From top to bottom, we'll maintain and service your home. To get started, we have a property inspection to determine what needs to be maintained, and a maintenance plan is created based on your preferences. From refrigerator coils to filters, vents, and drains, we do it all, and we do it well. Contact us today for your free routine maintenance inspection. And never worry about your maintenance again.
Jason Radisson on the Riderflex podcast. Hello, Jason. How you doing?
Hey, Steve. Good to be on.
Thanks.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for joining me. Are you in the Bay Area this morning?
I am in Minneapolis, bright and sunny Minneapolis this morning.
Actually. Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, my Zoom background is Big Sur for those of you Northern Californians out there. Love that place, and this in particular, we're having that kind of a day in Minneapolis today. Actually,
how about that? Are you there for business or
skies.
Personal or pleasure or?
A little bit of both, and actually have a flight here in a little bit, headed over to Europe. So a little bit of travel this week, kind of bouncing around.
You've been on the plane overseas to just a few places, I noticed, in your background. You've traveled just a little bit.
Just a little.
it
never grows old. Love experiencing new things and new places, and I think it's part of, there are some types of founders that are kind of truffle hunters and those of us that invest also. And sometimes you got to go to where the market is. Sometimes technology gives you a product, and part of that product market fit is sort of finding the right place where the pain is just right in the world to bring your product out. And my current company, we are helping a lot of ICPs who are sort of in that developing country, moving fast, not as tied to previous generations of HR technology, let's say, and just want the best technology they can get. And it's fun and it's rewarding if you can get those frequent flyer miles in and get out and see folks.
How many languages do you speak? Three, four?
Yeah, thereabouts. I have very rudimentary Portuguese, but business level Spanish. I've worked in Spain and in Latin America for years and years. And German goes way back. I started German when I was in high school. I lived in Germany and in Austria for probably about a dozen years, all told.
Wasn't your major in German?
Actually, second major in German.
That's what I thought. And you went to Holy Cross. Are you from Mass originally, or where'd you grow up?
I am. I'm from Western Mass. I grew up in a hill town called Munson, which back in the day was about 3,000 people. was the majority of my childhood. I was born in Springfield, Massachusetts, for those Western Mass folks out there, and I went to Holy Cross, and I went to Harvard in grad school. So a lot of Mass education there.
What'd your folks do?
So I was born to a 16-year-old single mom, actually, and we grew up. We kind of grew up together, which is a very rewarding and very tough experience, and I think a lot of just great life lessons there. And I had a wonderful stepdad from about 10 years old on, who was a machinist and worked in the latter part of his career on a bunch of prototypes in the medical industry, which is kind of interesting. How sort of in rural parts of the country and smaller cities, when there's a good manufacturing base, sort of the evolution of that manufacturing base is kind of interesting to see. And my first real break in my career, I worked for a company called American Saw and Manufacturing Company, East Longmeadow, Massachusetts, which made hand tools, the Lennox White tools that are out there for kind of professional trades folks, and industrial cutting tools and blades, saw blades for cutting metal. And one of my first jobs, I sort of cold applied, one of my first white collar jobs, cold applied to the sales VP, and talked myself into an internship doing their marketing in Germany, because I had a little bit of college German under my belt and high school German under my belt.
Okay. All right.
And I think this is like the summer before freshman year of college or so. And I ended up working for them for about 10 years on and off throughout school and grad school, and just a wonderful experience of, you know, the type of company that I think actually Germany and that part of the world, Central Europe, and the Japanese used to do so well, which is kind of the typical mechanical engineering export company, product company that exports hardware to different parts in the world. And it was one of those rare cases where you had a U.S. manufacturing company that had a very specific niche. They were actually fighting it out with one Japanese company and one German company for sort of most of the market share in the world on the professional side and on the high end. And I got to experience all that. And you know, like I said, language opened the door for
that?
A kid who grew up on a dirt road, you know, where the neighbors didn't wear shoes. It was quite an experience. It was quite an
were
experience
you,
to
is
get
it
there.
Is it fair to say you were a blue collar kid that ended up being the first Ivy League college student in his family? Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How about that? How about that? Your mom must be super proud. Is she still alive, by the way?
She is. Yeah.
Okay. Did you bring her out to California?
No, actually, she is. She's in Florida and she loves it. which
great.
Has been, you know, it's I wish it were California, you know, I wish it were somewhere other than Florida, because I don't really have business reasons to go to Florida. It's nice to go visit, but it's always nice when anyway, have you know, a work trip or something and can see family.
She must be super proud. Were you always a straight A student? Like, was it like that in high school? Like, you were just straight arrow, never in trouble, always 4.0. I mean, was it like that for
Yeah, for the most part, I think, you know, there's something, it's sort of, the self-motivation, it kicked in a little later. I want to say it kicked in at about 15 or so.
Okay.
And, you know, I was young for my grade, and I think, you know, a lot of folks can probably relate to this. You know, going back, if your parents needed to work, you started school early, you know, and
that's
some
right.
of it, you know, and you can sort of see that in many different lenses. But I think, you know, the main motivation is usually economic for a lot of families.
That's true.
And that's harder these days.
Yeah.
We've got a couple young kids. I've got four kids and two younger ones, and two teenagers and two under five. And there's this, you know, definitely we're starting school later. Everybody's starting school later. You know, and the Finnish, and I think the Koreans do something similar, where kids don't really start first grade until they're seven in Finland. Because all of the data point that, you know, the later you start them, the better they do. But anyway, you know, as a kid of a single mom in the 70s, I started school, you know, when I was in five when I was in first grade, and I was 17 when I graduated high school and started college. So that
now,
was just kind of how we did it.
Is there anything you want to confess? I mean, did you ever get in any trouble? Did you ever do anything wild?
Oh, sure.
I mean, come on.
You
You had
know,
there had to be something in there. I mean, come
you know, yeah, no, I mean, you know,
on.
we got in trouble. We got in enough trouble. We got in our own version of trouble. You know, which was mostly shooting our guns in the woods,
Right.
and you know, getting tickets because of the season that was or wasn't, or the distance we
I
were
got
or weren't, and you know, for a Boy Scout, you know, ex-Boy Scout, I'm not super proud of it, but that's probably about the most trouble
That's about okay. All right. And
we
you got
ever got into.
four kids, married with four kids, is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Okay,
Yeah.
very good. How'd you meet your wife?
Actually, we met in Las Vegas, which is kind of cliché, but
Wow, how
anyway.
about that? I just
Yeah.
assumed you'd met her overseas somewhere. You've been to so many different countries. Wow, you met in Vegas.
No,
How about
no.
that? How? What
Yeah,
were you
yeah.
at a club or something, dancing or what? What had you? What? She's
Something like that.
across the room.
Kind of. So
Wow.
old
All right.
old school, yeah.
This is back before you had the dating app, so you actually had to walk across the room and say, "Hi, my name's Jason."
Something.
Does she, I guess she does she work with you in the business, or she takes care of the four little ones, or what's she do?
she has her own career,
Okay.
absolutely. 100%. You know, working for a large tech company,
I see.
as an exec at a large tech company.
Okay, very good. She's not an entrepreneur necessarily, but she is in tech.
Yeah, it's all, yeah. We have tech conversations, you know, not related to, you know, the specifics, but generally, you know, we're both kind of in the same field,
You
which
worked
is
for
nice.
McKinsey. You worked for McKinsey early on. Did you always have an entrepreneurial investor mindset? Were you thinking way back then, like, yeah, this is cool, but I'm going to eventually be an investor and a founder? Or what was the early plan?
I think it's two things. I think one, the experience of having to bootstrap, you know, and founders out there that are listening to this that are bootstrappers will know. It's just it's a discipline. You know, you're working basically for the market, and the only points that matter are the value creation, and you either have the value creation or you don't. And if you don't, you're looking for it. And I think that's one experience that anybody that kind of, you know, grew up in the way that I did, you know, that shares that kind of a background, we had to do it. Otherwise, we're not here talking on a podcast about startups. We're, you know, maybe in prison or, you know, maybe in a very different sort of life, because certainly the odds are stacked against you.
Yes.
I think the other thing is, you know, I alluded to like my experiences, and I worked all kinds of blue collar jobs. Probably the one I liked the most was sheet metal work. I loved HVAC work. I did a
Oh.
bunch of HVAC work
Okay.
and short order cooking in school,
Cool.
all the way back to my early mid-teens. And I think, you know, the first job where I had a white collar job, and you know, with Linux, I was doing kind of business analysis, a lot of spreadsheet work, a lot of marketing work, some sales and pre-sales. And pretty soon after, you know, some internships and working on the part-time while I was going to school and everything, what I ended up getting exposed to very early on was a general management view. And you know, they would send me in, I'd have to sort of dive in and work with local teams. And so, you know, let's see how the Austrian facility is doing. Let's see how the Dutch facility is doing. Let's see, you know, what's going on with our German P&L. And I think when you get that exposure very early, a lot of people don't get it. And then, you know, you just look at the world differently. And so one of the things I always advise everybody, or, you know, folks that are on my team and folks that are coming up, it's you really have to get P&L exposure really, really early on. And even if you don't like it, it will sort of, I think, put context on everything else in your business career. And you know, certainly I've worked in some very big companies, some Fortune 100 companies with big responsibilities, with, you know, $100 million a month kind of responsibilities. And you'd be surprised how many people you find in those settings that have never had a P&L. And once you've had it, you sort of, then and then you start to see a business as in three dimensions as a living, breathing thing, and you start to understand better how to feed it and how to care for it, how to grow it. I think long answer to your question, but fundamentally, I had that P&L experience as a teenager, exposure as a teenager, and just took that away with me. And so I just have always seen my career as kind of, the development of those skills, and I'm still working on that same general management skill set. And will be till the day I hang up my hat, whenever that is.
Great advice for the listeners right there. For anybody listening to this show, you probably, I don't know if you know this, but I'm in the recruiting business too. RyderFlex is a recruiting firm in our day job, it's, we always, get profiles where they, somebody will be in the interview process and they'll say, well, I was over $100 million. I'm over $100 million department. And yeah, you kind of are, because you're over sales for the $100 million department, or if you're over marketing for the, but you're not in charge of the entire P&L. And I think that's really good career advice. Just because you are responsible for a lot of top line revenue on your resume is not as powerful as I had complete P&L control and responsibility, expenses, net income, the whole thing. It's just much more powerful, and it's a wonderful experience. So yeah, great advice.
It
Great,
is.
great.
It is. And I think the second part of that advice too is, at some point it never hurts to have a Fortune 100 or a name brand on your resume. And particularly if you're bootstrapped and you went through a community college or however you got to wherever you are, if you're able, to get that kind of branding on your resume, fantastic. People definitely use it early in their career to filter candidates, and it's going to be a mark of quality.
That's
But I
true.
think the other part of it is that, all being said, I've personally experienced, and I've seen more careers accelerated by a mid-cap company that's run really well, and by a rapidly scaling startup, not a pre-seed, but a Series B, Series C in there, than almost any other place. And I think, because the second part of that is, you're not going to go to Facebook early in your career, or another several $100 billion company and get a big P&L, or even a small
That's right.
P&L.
That's
And if it is a P&L, it'll be something so small that nobody cares about it, and you won't even be able to get people to schedule meetings with you. But in one of these smaller ones, they'll give you a country. They'll give you a division. You basically get to act like a regional president with that, kind of general manager responsibility. And they may give that to you when you're out of college, which, that's the kind of accelerator. And that's, I tell all the time, I provide, my opinion on people coming out of college, coming out of an MBA program, starting a company, is don't. It's work for a founder and a founding team that's going to give you that experience, that's going to give you a job rotation, that's going to share with you, in between meetings, the 10 things that they did wrong when they were your age, or the 20 things they did wrong when they were your age, to save you wasting all of that time of your precious lifetime and life energy making mistakes the hard way. It's much more efficient to go work for somebody covered in scars like me, and then I can tell you, share my 100 don'ts with you, and do that for 2 years, and then go start your own company. You'll be much better off for
Speaking of the scars, and then we can get off of this topic.
it.
I was recently visiting with a young CEO. He's probably 40 years old. First time he's been in the captain's chair. It's under $100 million, but it's so interesting to watch the behaviors of a first-time CEO that has only been with a company that's done this so far, and never had any speed bumps, never had any hurdles, never had any crisis stuff, and there's this weird false sense of security as, I'm the captain and I've been here 4 years and all we've done is this. And as I visit with him, I think to myself, yeah, your cockiness will be you'll be as soon as you get a few scars on your back, let's have another conversation. Anyway.
Exactly. Exactly. And they, you know, and those might just be bus tires from your board.
Let's
But
get
you
in.
know, and it's, and
Yeah,
it
go ahead.
is, you know, I think the experience of having suffered loss, and adversity is, it's very important in life. It's, you know, it is part of the human condition, and it, you kind of, need to have it. And if you're having it for the first time, you know, and you're out there listening to this, it's okay. It'll, it
Good
too will
point.
pass, and you know, 6 months or a year, of suffering is part of the journey.
It is.
We all kind
It
of go
is.
through as execs.
Let's talk about Movo. Let's get into it a little bit. Your current company. So you're the CEO and founder. And by the way, for the listeners, Movo.co,
That's right.
Movo.co. Maybe we start with the elevator pitch first, or just kind of give us the overview, and then I can hit you with some questions. Let's talk about it. Go for it.
So in a sentence, we're building an HCM platform for frontline workers. And it's a space that, you know, has a lot of attention, has had a lot of attention since the pandemic. Our journey, and I'll get to our journey in a second, but you know, as we see it, the goal and really the value unlock for the world is, you know, if you look at the frontline workforce, people who generally work without a desk, work in jobs in healthcare and hospitality and retail, in logistics and manufacturing, they haven't seen the kind of productivity bump that white collar workers have seen. They haven't benefited in the same way from the internet and from desktop computing and from, you know, remote conferencing and the kinds of technologies we're all using. And that, if you know, kind of turn back the clock, has added something like almost a doubling in the productivity of the white collar workforce. So what we do by Wednesday afternoon is what we used to do by Friday evening. And these folks, you know, not so much. And you know, depending on where you go in the world, that problem is more or less pronounced. And you know, there are, and thing technology is so unevenly distributed in the world, it just always baffles me. But there are really big companies with, you know, 80, 100,000 workers that are doing things with pen and paper, and you know, really just old school and suboptimal. So what we're trying to do with Movo, and the places, the first places that we focused, we built a bunch of bots. We built a really nice employee experience. So it's a mobile app where they download things and they can kind of see their whole working life, and supervisors can see all of their teams and really experience kind of that gig economy, real-time interaction with everybody on everything, whether it's tasks or whether it's on the schedule or you know, back office things, or even just chat, secure chat and communicating. And then our AI investment has really been on optimizing shifts and optimizing substitutions, such that nobody really has to worry about the roster. The roster sort of takes care of itself, and it's integrated into your labor forecasting. So, you know, you get as close to the optimal number of employees on every team. Why do we focus there? Because recruiting is harder and harder. You know, a lot of companies are still strapped for employees, and this is, you know, to our sort of mind and analysis of the situation and sort of what we've been experiencing in the market, is the single biggest lever you can pull. If you can help people to have each of their teams optimally staffed, you know, you're going to drop 10, 20 plus percent to the bottom line in a big company. And so that's where we focused. We built some other cool features. We built a task optimizer, task distributor. So we're not distributing rides at Uber, we're distributing tasks at big retailers, hospitals, et cetera. But you're able to distribute tasks from headquarters to 1,000 people simultaneously. You see them all get completed on the map, and in any real-time reports and dashboards, these kinds of things. So in a nutshell, it's really, yeah, it's really a gig style experience, but for people's W-2 employees.
It sounds like it's one app that replaces 20 apps. It's one central app that does a lot of things that I used to have to open 20 different apps to do. Is that?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And all that functionality and data is really important. You know, as we're sort of coming to market in the US and we've largely been in beta and doing a lot of things with the latest version of our platform overseas. Mm-hmm. But as we're coming to market, a lot of the discussions are, you know, folks want a couple of the really cool features. And then as they look at it, they're like, you know, sort of drawing the same conclusion. Actually, I could probably retire these three or four other apps. We've got to play well, and we do play well with the really big HRIS and kind of conventional players. We don't tend to get into payroll. We send a very clean payroll extract, continually reported out if you're doing early wage access to your payroll system or company. But Movo is fundamentally about that real-time workforce management, you know, everything sort of in your pocket experience.
Right now, let me give you some things, tools that we're using at Riderflex, our recruiting firm. Tell me which ones of those could be replaced or stopped if I was using Movo. So, and I'm just off the top of my head here. I'm not looking at a list. I mean, we use an applicant tracking system. We use HubSpot for sales. We use Evernote for tasks. We use MetaView for note-taking and recording interviews. We use Google Drive for storing our information. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think. There's so many others. There's more stuff in there. I mean, how many, like, can I stop using my applicant tracking system?
You absolutely can. And that was actually the first thing that we built in sort of the heat of the pandemic. And if we have time, I can tell a little bit more of some of those war stories. But we started in high volume hiring. That was the first bunch of AI that we built. Okay. And it was fundamentally, and it's still the core applicant experience we have, is the applicant applies for a job. And if it's on a job board, generally will have an integration with that job board.
I see.
And they'll immediately get a link to download the white label version of your employment process.
Okay.
And then inside of Movo, we sort of create the entire employment packet in the background by having the applicant just go through a couple screens. It takes about 2 minutes. And then, you know, we get enough of the equivalent of a job offer that we feel fine with compliance and running background. We check any databases, other databases, whether it's like a nursing database, or academic credentials, these kinds of things. And we serve up the ready to go candidate. And then if the organization still wants to interview them, they can. If they want to just send them to a group interview or an orientation session, they can. And during the pandemic, we hired 700,000 people in the US during the pandemic for our clients.
Wow.
We had some really large clients, including Amazon.com.
Nice.
And that was really sort of how, you know, we started the code. Like, I started it literally sort of on like the end of 2019 with some pilots in market. And then we all went full time in January, the beginning of January in 2020. And we're just kind of getting the legs under us when the pandemic happened.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the, yeah.
It was crazy. Yeah.
Does it replace my desktop and my app on the phone?
Yeah.
Both? Okay.
It's totally, right. It's fundamentally the experience that matters most. You know, no offense to all of us that spend, for those of us that are out there that spend most of our time at a desk, the experience is really built to be mobile first.
Okay.
And the mobile app gets it all done and is geo-aware and always on, and well, everything's in real time.
Yeah.
And then if you're sitting at your desktop and you're using Movo through a web browser, then what you get is sort of a God's eye view on everything that's going on.
Okay.
You're not a supervisor
Okay.
looking at a shift or two. If you have the permissions, you can see all shifts. You could see, we have some really great dynamic reports where you can watch the shift health. So as all the shifts are checking in and all as they're all balancing out, you can see where you've got imbalances.
I
You
like
can
it.
see people moving between shifts if you're doing, substitution automatically. In the
I'm
recruiting
thinking about
flow,
the I'm thinking about the
yeah.
retail the retail manager, the restaurant manager,
Yeah.
the construction site manager. None of those people are sitting at their desks for very long.
Right,
So they
right. Yeah. So headquarters could, and that's sort of if you were looking at it and said, okay, I want to look across a region. I want to see 87 restaurants in real time. And that's a little bit, the gig economy and in we haven't mentioned it, but I ran part of the country for Uber in a previous life. And I think one of the experiences that we had so strongly in the gig economy that I wanted to replicate at Movo is the experience of just looking at a map and seeing a million workers doing stuff. And that all sounds really abstract and kind of science fiction-y, except over time, you get used to it. In the same way, probably an air traffic controller looks at a, their grid and just knows whether or not things are going right. And there's a lot that in a gig platform, we're sort of always distributing tasks. We're sort of always managing the workforce in real time at massive scale. And so that is the web interface is more about that. It's more about giving you that kind of God's eye view. And then, if you're a floor supervisor, say you're running, three floors of a hospital, you look inside Movo and you have absolute situational awareness on everybody. You look back in time, forward in time, and see everything that's going on. So that's, fundamentally, you have a real-time tool set that is
I
very
like it.
unique. Yeah.
Does it let I'm really drilling down here a little bit, maybe getting
Yeah, no.
too
Okay,
far in the
good.
weeds, but does it let
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the frontline workers and like restaurants and retail and construction and all these people that always have call outs and no shows and associates
Right.
trying to trade shifts and all this stuff. If I'm the manager of a big retail location, will it let my associates trade amongst themselves to switch out shifts and then I'm just notified to, instead of the old days where like the associate calls me, hey, I'm calling out today, and now I got to pick up the phone and call
Yeah.
five other associates.
That's one of the biggest pain points that we've gone after is, particularly in retail. You mentioned retail. I mean, fast foods, not too different either. And
Same, yeah, same.
where supervisors might spend half their time on the roster and scheduling.
Totally.
And so the mobile experience, in either direction, but let's talk about it from the worker experience, from the employee experience. They go in, and if they need a schedule modification or need time off, they submit that request. And 9 times out of 10, the system automatically clears it. If, caveat, the client wants it that way. If the client's like, no, supervisor needs to approve everything, we're talking a different story. But as long as a client is comfortable with the bot doing it, then, the employee is basically interacting with the bot, submitting the request. The bot is checking to see that they're suitable alternates. And depending on the SLA it has with those alternates. So if it's got a rock solid SLA with an alternate, it just puts that alternate in, approves the request, it's all done, which is just so great for the employee, right? Because they don't have
Oh, man.
to go ask the supervisor for a favor,
Love it.
go, anything. They can just take that time off.
Okay, very
It's of
cool.
course PTO balance aware, overtime aware, and any other considerations might have.
I love
And
it.
then we also the way we've implemented shift swapping is not it's not literally a shift swap because there's no immediate quid pro quo, but basically it's sort of peer substitution. So when I'm going to put in my time off request, I get a list, a pre-approved list of people who haven't committed to take my shift, but have the time available, have the skills available to take my shift. And I can set out, depending on how many sort of the client lets us do, but I could send out 10 different requests simultaneously. And the first peer that comes back and says, yeah, I'll take that shift and commits to it, is the one that gets it. So generally we do that FIFO.
Cool.
And it's just, we've come up, I think we have, you know, just a really elegant and easy to use, user-friendly experience for doing all of this and really just unburdening everyone. And I think the nice thing too, when you have that, you know, when, you know, the AI is running in the background, basically supervisors, to state the obvious, they can do more important things than chase down people on their schedule. But secondarily, you know, they can go and they can really work on the most important staffing. So, you know, I want this particular nurse on this particular surgery, you know, and they can make that happen. And then the bottle backfill wherever that particular nurse's regular shift was, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just nice having, you know, what ultimately is, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of hours of kind of just grind kind of low quality work, having a bot take that off everybody's plate.
I spent
that's one of the biggest ones.
I spent 15 years in retail as a multi-unit manager and store manager and regional manager. So I, believe me, I can relate to everything we're talking about. Let's, I want to talk about the business overall. Is the business, so it's a SaaS business, and is the model per user? What, talk to me about the business model.
You know, eight, nine times out of 10, it's per user per month. You know, we will do, you know, kind of bulk pricing and flat pricing, and we get into that kind of thing. But
initial setup fee or no?
Yeah, depending on the size of the engagement, it can be nominal. We tend to, because we're a small company, and you know, we're flying in a senior engineer or a field engineer. If we're gonna, we tend to be quick. And the deployment is the kind of deployment you'd expect from the gig economy. So, you know, basically the employees download the app. If we've gotten some really good data feeds, then we'll already have pre-accounts created for them. That kind of thing, have supervisors already set up. And so it's basically a little bit of final parameter setting and, you know, that pre-account creation, parameter setting. And then third bucket is kind of train the trainer, getting everybody into change management sessions.
Okay.
But generally we're up and running in 2 or 3 weeks. So it's, you know, for folks that are looking at, oh my God, you know, my big platform is forcing me to upgrade and I've got this transition risk and everything like that. We love those kinds of opportunities, just kind of step in and help kind of knock out 80, 90% of the workforce management value with a couple week engagement.
Is this for a Fortune 500 retail chain, or is this for the mom and pop family that has two restaurants, or both?
It's for both. You get more value the more it scales, or the more you have, you know, a good liquid pool of workers where you really see, you know, the value over traditional ways of doing things, right?
Okay.
If I'm distributing tasks in a 10-person team and that's my only team, I can kind of do that on the floor. But if I'm distributing tasks, obviously, across 10,000 people, that's where you start to, the bigger the company tends to be, the more value.
So you're targeting mid-cap and up, kind of.
Mid-cap and up. That's right. Okay. That's right, Steve.
All right. Very good. Yeah. Thank you for that. How big is it? I don't know what you want to share. Do you want to share size of company, revenue, employee count in general?
Like, yeah. You know, we're a small senior team. We've, you know, it's, I find it's, you know, like a lot of things in life, it's better to do things once right than to, you know, worry about and have to work with low quality product that eventually improves. We do very high quality product. We have, our engineering team is, based in Bucharest, Romania. It's a bunch of very senior folks that I've worked with on and off for the last 15, 20 years. So we build things that don't break, that scale really nicely. You know, the rest of the cash. Team.
You've raised some cash, I saw. Crunchbase says, talk to me about cash raise. What do you want to share?
Yeah, so we raised probably one of the larger seeds out there. And we've been really capital efficient so far. We'll be looking at going back to market probably this year. We raised in 2021 primarily. That was almost what was it? A little over 8 million in our seed, all told.
Ah, nice.
And
Wow, good for
it was a
you.
nice seed.
Yeah,
It was a nice
seriously.
market back then.
Wow, congratulations. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
nice.
thanks.
Okay, all
And
right.
then the only raise we've done since has been we did 1 million last year, which was
Saw that.
strategic.
Yeah,
We
okay.
raised both from Jobs for the Future.
Okay.
For folks that are out there, future of work investor, closely affiliated with a bunch of Fortune 100 companies and the U.S. Department of Labor. And we also raised from SHRM, from the Global
Nice.
HR
Yeah.
Association. So,
Congratulations. So
yeah, thanks.
you're still raising cash, burning cash, and growing, right? I mean,
Yeah,
you're not, okay.
we'd rather raise and grow fast than
Okay.
not raise and try to bootstrap everything, for
What's your
sure.
target for profitability? You got a magic date?
We've been right around break even
Oh.
for the last couple of quarters. So
Oh, all right.
yeah.
Yeah, your investors like
Recovering,
that.
it depends on the week and month, but really close, really close.
I don't know if you want to answer this one. Now, I'm assuming if you've raised $9 million, I'm guessing Jason does not have more than 51% control of the cap table. So now you're kind of answering to the board. I'm guessing. I don't know what you want to share.
That's a tricky one, but let's just say we're very tightly held.
Right, sounds good.
I think part of it too is and another some maybe this will be helpful for other folks on this path too, but we were when we started the company, I bootstrapped it. We bootstrapped it. So
Okay.
we
Who's
raised
we? Who's
in
we? You and a couple of friends, you and okay.
And a couple of ex-Uber and
Okay.
kind of some other
All right.
friends
All
and
right.
associates. And we were able to kind of de-risk a lot of the early product market fit and sort of the initial push of the company. This will sound familiar, but basically by sole hats. So I was investing, and I was advising quite a bit in 2019, 2018, 2019, in that time frame, as we were getting things lined up. And one company in particular, I was working closely with the Rappi guys, who had been helping sort of with their scale up and with some of their growth pains. And so, we avoided a lot of that early burn where you got five full-time guys and everybody still needs to eat, and so investors are, you keep selling your stock to investors to keep the company going before you really have things going. We were able to really kind of have a company before we ever had
Nice.
to go to the capital markets. And even, I don't know, if things had been different, if the pandemic hadn't happened, we might never have raised capital. We might have bootstrapped all the way.
Okay.
Because as it was, we were about break even. We were doing a bootstrappy, very slow thing, as slow as we could. And not sort of flame out and get into working cap needs and everything. And the pandemic, sort of late 2020, we started getting inbound, which is like, hey, we heard you guys are like working with Amazon, like keeping them in warehouse workers, the whole hire, train, deploy model was like not such a almost cliche at that point. You know what I mean? It was still people were like, wait, where did you guys get this idea? And it's like, well, it's kind of been cooking on it since like 2015. It took us a few years to like actually get our crap together and start a company here. But yeah, we're supplying Amazon and we got all this cool work we're doing. And we were at
Nice.
the time on hiring. Hiring was so strapped in the US market. I was literally saying to my investors, those early investors, like, my hand hurts from signing so many contracts. Like, we had, and like, no prayer of really truly filling all the demand. And we'd have these conversations with clients like, you asked us to hire 2,000 people for you. We're really good. We think we can hire immediately 200, but I don't know what we're going to do with the other 1,800. Like, that's. We had hundreds of millions of dollars of open orders, and in the pandemic, in the heat of the pandemic, no way that we could ever get there.
I don't know how many times my co-founder at Riderflex early on, he would call me and be like, holy shit, Steve. He's like, I just signed a contract with ABC company and they want XYZ. Can we do it? And I'm like, I don't know. Let's figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, and it's, and it does come down to the college try and everything's relative, right? And that's, we'd get the feedback like, we gave the same contract, by the way, to 8 vendors and you guys were the only ones that delivered anything. The other guys delivered 2 new hires or something, you know?
Yeah, cool.
So,
cool.
You know, cool. It that was how, you know, it's funny, but you know, if you and I ever write anything about the pandemic, right? Like this is the crazy world that we were living in.
No doubt. With the time we have left, I want to ask you about AI in general. We have just a few minutes left. Mm-hmm. Before I do that, though, before we switch gears, Movo.co, Movo.co, just so everybody knows, you can go there. Yep. And they have a contact page, yep, information page, et cetera.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Jason Radisson also has quite a big following on LinkedIn. I don't know if you're taking new connections, but, you know.
Always.
If anybody always wants to reach out to you.
Yep.
Interesting time we're living in with this AI.
Yeah.
I know we could probably schedule you for another hour and just talk about AI advancements and everything that's happening.
Yeah.
A lot of things in the news, a lot of big players with AI. ChatGPT-4 kind of changed the world a little bit. Where are we going? I mean, what do you think? What do you think, Jason? Where are we?
Yeah,
headed?
Yeah.
Where are we headed? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, and I, you know, for the listeners out there, you know, a big part of what I did coming up was develop algorithmic systems for big companies. So that was like this dual role usually of running the marketing budget, you know, oftentimes in a merger and acquisition scenario. And then basically taking the automated systems of one company and putting them into another. And whether I was a McKinsey consultant or I worked with Mike Sievert back at AT&T Wireless. When we did a roll up there, I worked with Gary Loveman over at Harris Entertainment when we did a roll up in that industry. But you kind of, you know, when you look at consumer AI, you know, there have been purpose-built AIs, machine learning kind of systems out there for 30 plus mm-hmm. years, at extreme scale. I mean, you know, some of the work we did in e-commerce, some of those systems see 1 billion transactions, 1 billion interactions a month, that kind of scale. And, you know, I think B2B is harder, right? Like consumer, you know, largely what we've been able to do in consumer is first everybody had a PC and then everybody had a mobile phone. And so you kind of always have the data in consumer. If the system's halfway interesting and attractive and gets good engagement from consumers, you are going to be able to figure stuff out and build really cool solutions off of that. You fast forward to now in this moment in B2B, and you know, I think the real challenge is, and I'll just focus on where I think the unmet opportunity is, and it's sort of the difference for a SaaS founder today working in AI versus a SaaS founder working in cloud 5-7 years ago is, you know, fundamentally there was a whole landscape of specific, I'll call them, and nobody please take offense, but I'll call them specific ERPs. So specific cloud ERPs that were targeted to a specific niche mm-hmm. and did something just world-class that a bunch of customers needed. That was the formula for success. And the problem, the advantage of that is when you're working in that mode, you're sort of extending the human with a system. And you put a little bit of automation in there to kind of pump up the human's capability and their performance. Okay. The problem you get into with automation is, you know, and I think a lot of what this next generation of SaaS startups is going to be is you really don't need or want the human in the loop. Because there's no point for them being in the loop, frankly, if it's, you know, consolidating paperwork or summarizing documents or, you know, and. So it's a different kind of change hurdle. It's a very different kind of buying experience. It's going to move, and we'll see where it ends up. It's going to move system integration consulting. It's going to move their cheese too. because you know it's going to be more managing the systematic change than it is managing the human elements of the change. It's a very, very different world. And I think what we're going to get into is, you know, I don't think that the chat interface is the interface. I think they're going to be a lot more standard and visual interfaces that are a lot more efficient, right? You'd never want to fly. We'll have,
are we headed towards AGI? Is the, you know, are we headed towards just an assistant on my screen that just talks to me and just does whatever I need it to do? Is that
maybe, in some use cases for sure. I think we're headed towards is vertical. And if you want to prioritize them, if you're, you know, listening to this and you invest in the space, I think you want to prioritize them by the big problems that have really good data and maybe some moats around that data. And then, you know, basically if you can get you have to kind of do three things in my mind. You've got to get a lock on some data and build some moats around it. You've got to have some unique perspective on the actual algorithmic portion, whatever your AI and how that system's working and how it becomes smart and how smart it is. Although that's largely a function of what the data quality is, I think, going into it anyway. And then you've got to have a really unique perspective on the UI. And some of it will be bots that, you know, these smart agents, and you just chat with them or you just talk to them. But if you think about how so much runs in the world, like the metaphor I would say is like, look at a plane, you know, and you wouldn't want a pilot running a plane on voice. Because it's just too inefficient, you know. Voice and speech and chat we're all limited by sort of the pipe. Versus visually, you can look at 100 dials, and get a visual picture of so much more. It's just so much more information rich. Mm. So you know, I think there's a new kind of Cambrian explosion coming, and it's going to be just taking and whatever's underneath the hood, whether it's, you know, generative AI or if it's, you know, plain old machine learning, but, you know, generating these vertically specific automation players, plugging them into companies.
Are you in, last question, I know we're out of time. Which camp are you in? Are you in the camp of there'll be universal basic income and lots of jobs lost and a lot of people won't work? Or are you on the other side where, no, all this is going to do is create more jobs and more creativity and it'll all be fine?
I'm in both camps. I'm first in the second camp. So I think humans are, I think we got some more years.
Okay.
You know, I think they're, you know, and we're seeing it. The future is already here, right? We've seen so much of this, even over the past couple of years, where, you know, I think generative AI really sort of at this point replaces entry level white collar work. Yes. So it is really sort of the key challenge of how to recent college grads get senior fast. Because you look at, you know, in a bunch of, you know, sort of technical white collar jobs, you know, if you're a senior attorney, if you're a senior backend developer, if you're and senior data scientist, there's so much of that legwork that you can do with a Gen AI system now.
Yep.
So I think that means that sort of careers level up. If you look at work that our company is doing to sort of remove kind of the mundane work from frontline work, and just outsource it to bots. You know, I think that all is going to play out. That'll play out for quite some time. Cause I don't think, at least in blue collar work and sort of deskless work, until we've got really good robots.
I mean, did you see the figure? Did you see the figure
hardware
one
problem?
Did you see the figure one video?
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. Well, yeah, but you've got to do it at scale.
Okay.
Like, you know, the problems have to, you know, they've got to be, it's going to work. It's going to work its way up. And I think that's maybe sort of my general theme is, you know, automation works its way up from the least valuable jobs, right? So the challenge is always like staying and leveling up into higher level jobs and staying ahead of things.
Okay.
So it lifts everybody up. And yes, there's, you know, there is a scenario where, you know, we have just this general intelligence that's so good. It's so much more intelligent than any individual could ever be that we're kind of obsolete, but I don't think that's
good
anytime
well,
soon.
Well, hey, I'm ready. You know what? Listen, I live in Colorado and I go camping and I'm a big Jeep guy and I go to the mountains and hike and camp. And so, hey, as soon as I don't have to work and we have robots do everything,
right.
I'm totally fine with that.
Right, right.
Anyway,
I'll get out in the outdoors more.
Yeah. Jason, great, great conversation. Really appreciate you being on the Rider Flex show. Thank you very much, sir. And congratulations on everything you've built.
Thanks so much, Steve. I really enjoyed being on.